first case this morning is number 06-5086, Avtec Corporation against the United States. Mr. Weeks.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court, we are here today for the court to decide what the term fixed fee means in federal government contracting with respect to cost reimbursable fixed fee level of effort contracts. The dispute arises out of a series of contracts being performed at the U.S. Army Aviation and Missile Command in Huntsville, Alabama. These contracts all were for a varying degree of technical services to support the missile range at Redstone Arsenal, which is involved in missile testing for the Army and other services. The heart of our case, in my view, deals with what the meaning of fixed fee is. FAR 16306 defines a fixed fee as a fee that cannot vary with cost and is fixed at inception. The dispute arises over the meaning of the fixed fee with respect to certain options that are in the contract. We assert that options...
So your theory is that if the government exercises the option for 1 hour, you get the entire fixed fee?
That's correct.
How does that make sense?
Well, if you take a look at the base contract, if the government awards the base contract, and shortly after the base period of the contract has been awarded and only a third of the hours have been expended, the contractor is still entitled to the fixed fee. What I would point out to the court is that the government is in charge of deciding what type of contract to award, the terms of those contracts, and the manner in which work is placed on those contracts. The option quantity, the fixed fee for the option quantity, is set at the inception of the contract. It is a fixed number, regardless of the number of hours that...
But that doesn't explain why the parties would have contracted to pay the entire fixed fee for 1 hour of work.
Your Honor, the purpose of a cost-reimbursable fixed fee contract is to fix the profit that a contractor will get on a particular segment of work on the contract. If the contract had had no options, there would be no dispute, even if the government had only used 1 hour of work. The contractor is entitled to the entirety of the fixed fee, which the parties agreed to at the inception of the contract.
That's for the base period.
It's for the entire period of the contract. The language in the contract which attempts to vary that is the provision which is in our brief at page 19. We used one particular contract as an example rather than the entire range of contracts. The administrative record would have been larger than I could carry if that had been otherwise.
So let me ask you this. The base period concludes. Then you move into the first of the, I guess there's three option periods.
Right. The government may award an option.
Right. Now, it's conceivable that there would be no work under an option period.
Correct. And in that event, the government is not required to exercise the option.
And you're not, and in that event, you wouldn't get a fee.
That's correct.
So you're saying, though, that to pick up on what Judge Dyke was saying in his discussion with you, that if they order just one, if they order nothing, they don't pay a fee.
That's correct.
But if they order just 1 hour, they pay the whole $170,000.
That's correct. The government's
in
charge.
To again continue what he was saying, I understand your argument, but it just when one looks at that, it seems counterintuitive. It seems difficult to me to conceive of why anybody would enter into that kind of contractual arrangement.
If they did not have the necessary work to support the option, they were in charge of not exercising the option.
Right.
The problem is here that my client, the contractor, Amtec Corporation, is not in charge of the number of hours that is placed on that particular contract. The fixed fee is essentially one element of the fixed fee. Is to pay for the standby costs that my client incurs The United States, in order to support the work at Redstone Arsenal, has elected not to use full-time civil servants with the full range of expertise that is required to perform this contract, rather to use a support contractor. So we are required to have all of those people either on staff or as consultants, and that's a cost to us, which comes out of the profit.
But if the government, doesn't order anything, you don't get a cent.
If the government elects not to exercise an option, we can reduce our staff. We aren't then obligated.
They would say they exercise the option. They say, all right, we're in the option period, but then they don't order anything.
I don't believe an option can be exercised without some order. The operative phrase is they have to exercise the option. If they exercise the option without a limitation, it's the entire 150.
Looking at after the base period ended, did the option period, when the base contract ended, you were automatically in what I would call, I guess, the option period, correct?
If no option was exercised, we were no longer obligated to perform.
Right, but how long did this? You have your option one, total of 154,800 man hours, right?
Correct.
Now, that came into existence when?
At the inception of the contract.
At the inception of the contract, right.
There is a base period and there were several option periods in each of these contracts.
So the base period is ended. Right?
Correct.
And we're now in the first option period.
If an option had been exercised for some amount.
How long does the period last during which the government can
There's a provision in the contract, and I'm not sure exactly what this is, that the option must be ordered within a certain period of time. Otherwise, it just simply expires and we're no longer able to.
So the government has the base period ends.
Correct.
And then we enter the option period. And the government has from, I'll just pick an arbitrary date, March the 1st of 2000 to February the 28th of 2001, okay?
Sure.
And it can, during that period, order up to 154,800 hours, correct?
Right.
And if it doesn't order anything during that period, the contractor doesn't get anything, even though the contractor has to be on standby.
Right, we've taken that risk, that they will or will not.
But if it orders just 1 hour on July the 10th and nothing else, you get $170,000 in addition to the labor cost of that hour, right?
It depends. It doesn't depend. Suppose the government only orders 1 hour, but they wanted a rocket scientist to do this, and the only rocket scientist that was available charges $150,000 an hour. So we hire the rocket scientist that the United States essentially wants, the qualifications. He does the work. Now, is our fixed fee $1.10 for that $150,000 worth of work?
Well, under the government's reading of the contract, it is.
Right, that's their reading. We think.
What were the different hourly rates? I mean, we have here this $14.03. Now, that wasn't. There were different hourly rates charged, correct?
Yes, there were, and that's attached to Kelly Joyner's declaration.
What's the highest hourly rate?
The highest hourly rate was somewhere in the $65 or $70 range.
So the $170,000 an hour example is no relationship to this contract.
Well, it's an absurd example, but it makes
well,
a point.
Well, it doesn't happen to make a point.
The $70.
The highest rate here is $65 an hour.
Let's suppose the government orders 5 hours at $65 an hour.
I thought your example was the annual salary of the people that you need to keep on staff to perform these analyses.
That's a risk on the contractor with respect to having people available to fill the needs of this particular contract. The government chooses the work that it wants performed and the amount of hourly rates, not hourly rates, the amount of people that they want. The contractor then makes the mix of the technical staff that the government wants for their particular jobs. Some are higher than the $13 an hour in the contract. Some may be lower than the $13 an hour in the contract. And what Kelly Joyner's declaration points out is that in billing, after the work has been done, the hourly rates vary substantially, and we bill the fixed fee in accordance with the terms of the contract proportionally to the fixed fee, which is the way that it's generally done. After the contract is completed, the parties get back together and settle up on the firm, the fixed fee of the contract.
The contract here provides that it provides an hourly rate for the fixed fee, and it says that that's to be used for purposes of pricing, right?
That's correct.
Why doesn't that suggest that the fixed fee is to be priced on an hourly basis?
There's a difference between for pricing purposes and for reimbursement and payment purposes. The deposition of Wanda Preston, who was...
Well, forget about the deposition. We're dealing here with the plain language of the contract. Where in the contract does it suggest that the pricing rate for the fixed fee is to be adjusted later on when the final billing takes place?
Section B2 of the contract requires the contractor to bill the fixed fee proportionally to the cost for a provisional bill.
Where does it suggest that the final billing for the fixed fee, which is not listed as an estimated fixed fee, where does it suggest the final billing for the fixed fee is going to change?
Because the parties have entered into an agreement by which the entire fixed fee is paid. That's why it's fixed.
But it says a fixed fee per hour. Where does it suggest that the hourly rate of the fixed fee is going to change in the final billing?
The provision, Your Honor, which says for purposes of pricing, has a special meaning in this contract. And Wanda Preston, the supervisory contracting officer, testified as to her understanding of that term at the time this contract was awarded. And it was essentially for the purpose of pricing the work that various Army customers would pay to the United States Army Aviation and Missile Command to support the test that they needed run. It's not in any way related to the pricing of a fixed fee on an hourly rate. In addition...
The problem is that's what it says. It says pricing of the estimate per hour for labor, and it says fixed fee, $1.10 an hour.
The fixed fee at $1.10 an hour was never the practice of the parties.
Look at the practice of the contract is clear.
Absolutely, the practice of the contract is clear.
Even if it's clear, what case says that we can look at the practice of the parties when the contract is clear on its face?
I disagree that this is clear.
But assuming it's clear, what case says that we can look at the practice?
Well, if you accept this as being clear on its face, then I don't have an argument to make to you except to say that it is not clear on its face. And Ms. Preston's testimony makes clear that it's not clear on its face. This is in here for a specific purpose. If you look at the estimated cost schedule at B3, which is at page 2 of our reply brief, the estimated cost and fee associated with each option shall be stated in the contract modification in which the option is exercised. Pricing of the option quantity shall be as stated in B2 for the purpose of pricing.
Mr. Reese, let me ask you this. Let me work this through my mind. April the 1st said the government, we're in option one, the government orders services an hour of someone who costs, and their rate is $20 an hour.
Correct.
Okay? And I guess you submit invoices monthly?
Either bi-weekly or monthly.
Okay, but say it's monthly, just to make it easy. Say that's the only order that happens in April. The government ordered 1 hour of $20, of someone who costs $20 an hour. Now, On May the 1st, would the government get a bill in the amount of $20 or get a bill in the amount of $21.10?
The government would get a bill in the amount of the $20 of cost, direct cost, plus the proportional rate for the total fixed fee. In other words, when you do provisional billing, you bill the actual cost and a proportional rate. So our rate would be approximately 8% of the $20, whatever that comes out. That's how we bill. We never bill $1.10 an hour, except by a coincidence, for the recovery of cost and fee under this contract.
I don't understand what you mean by coincidence. Isn't that the way the billing is computed using the $1.10 an hour?
No, sir, it is not.
No.
And the declaration of Kelly Joyner explains that we bill actual costs for what was incurred under the contract, plus, as required by the contract, a proportional fixed fee for the purpose of a provisional billing rate. There was never any billing.
But that's $1.10, right?
No, sir.
What is it?
Well, it depends on the actual cost. If the actual cost was $20 an hour, it's 8%.
No, I'm saying that's his rate. Labor cost per hour, $20 an hour.
That's right. That's the labor rate plus the fixed fee.
But the fixed fee is $1.10 per hour.
No, it isn't.
That's what it says in the contract.
Well, I understand your view of that. I disagree with it. It's not a clear, unequivocal statement. It's for pricing purposes. And when Ms. Preston says pricing purposes is to determine how we charge the government customer, it has nothing to do with how we bill the contract.
It has nothing to do with how you bill the contract?
For the pricing purposes.
Well, what's the $1.10 used for?
The $1.10 is used to estimate the amount that they need to charge their customer on a provisional rate for the cost. They use the $13 or $14 an hour plus the provisional fixed fee and bill their client kicks in $15.13. If it's more than that, they go back to their client and get more money.
The fixed fee is 8% of the $15.13. And that's where the $1.10 came from.
That's correct.
When you billed the government, you didn't bill them for $170,000. You billed them for the actual cost of the hours worked, right? Just a moment.
Correct.
And plus, then you add an 8% fixed fee to that, right?
For a provisional billing rate, that's correct.
Well, why didn't you just bill them for the $170,000?
At the end of the term, at the end of the contract, that's where the parties in a cost reimbursable contract settle up. DCA comes out, they do an audit, they determine.
So what you're saying is that when you bill them for the actual cost, you never bill them for the $170,000. You only bill them at the actual hourly cost plus 8%.
Plus that portion of the fixed fee as required by the clause that deals with cost reimbursable contracts.
That's correct. You bill them for the actual cost plus 8%, right?
Right, and then we had a final invoice where we invoiced for the entire fixed fee. Now, we entered into a stipulation in this matter before the litigation started. The stipulation is written out at page 13 and 14 of our brief. There were five or six contracts that occurred prior to this contract, and in every one of those contracts, in some there were fewer hours than had been stated in the schedule that were ordered. We got the entire fixed fee in every one of those. And in some of those, there were DCA audits that told the contracting officer, you shouldn't do it this way, and the contracting officer elected to do it in the manner that the parties had done this work. So we think that certainly if there is an ambiguity, then we are certainly entitled to the previous course of dealing and course of action between the parties.
All right, let's hear from the government, and we'll save
your rebuttal
time. We
ask you more questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. The plain language of these contracts is clear in that the fixed fee is calculated on a per hour basis and not, as MTEC claims, on an aggregate basis.
But your contention is that it's not on $1.10 an hour, right? If I'm understanding the situation correctly, it's not that you take each hour and add $1.10 to it. It's the government's contention that it's 8% of the hourly cost. Am I correct about that or am I wrong?
No, it's confusing, Your Honor. And if we could look, well, the fee is calculated on a per hour basis. It was not billed. Antec is correct. It was not billed as $1.10 per hour. It was billed at an 8%.
Well, let me ask you a question. Suppose they worked 100 hours and the cost per hour, the actual cost per hour, was $20 an hour instead of the estimated cost of $14 an hour. Now, they worked 100 hours. Do you calculate the fixed fee by multiplying 100 by 110, or do you take 8% of the labor cost?
You would take, for billing purposes, and this
now, what's owed under the contract?
What's owed under the contract is 100 hours times $1.10.
It doesn't say that.
It's
estimate.
It's the per hour.
The contract says estimated.
The contract
says. But if they pay 8%, you say they pay 8%, but they don't owe 8%, they owe less than 8%, but they pay 8% anyway. That doesn't make sense either.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the interim billing mechanism, which is set up by clause B1 of the contract, provides for a proportional billing, and it is difficult to square that clause with the per hour clause, because if the cost. If the actual costs exceed the estimated costs, then you could theoretically end up with a fixed fee. If you calculate it on a proportional basis, you could end up with a fixed fee that exceeds even the total amount that's specified in the contract.
Well, that seems to be the purpose, doesn't it? They estimate 154,800 man hours of work. Let's say that the estimate is 100,000. So they order more than the estimated.
Right, that.
And you're saying they're prohibited from doing
that? They can't do that. The option has a ceiling number of man hours of 154,800. They can't order more than that number of man hours. The cost, as Amtec points out correctly, the cost of those man hours can exceed the estimated cost, as it did in contract 856. It exceeded it by approximately 24%. That the proportional billing clause, then theoretically, the numbers don't always add up, because if the costs exceed the estimated cost, then the proportion of the fee will also exceed the estimated proportion of the fee. It does not make sense.
But what's the problem? What's the proportional billing clause here?
It's clause B1. If you look at
B1, this is like on page.
It's on page A10439 in volume 2 of the appendix.
Because they're provided before the Court of Federal Claims calculations of the fixed costs, the standby costs, the costs that were incurred even if less than the maximum in the contract were ordered.
Yes, those costs are in the record. And so, for example,
but the government's position is that's too bad. If you don't order a sufficient number of analyses, if you don't order enough work, those costs are not to be recovered.
I think that's correct, Your Honor, yes. If
you think or you know?
Well, I'm a little unclear about exactly what you're asking, but if the government exercises a certain number of hours, then the fixed fee for those hours is set by either that number of hours or by this proportional billing clause. One or the other, but not by the total fee as antitrust.
Yeah, but what's, I don't understand, I'm trying to understand what the government's position is. There are 100 hours that are ordered at $20 an hour, and at the end of the day, when the, everything's reconciled, what's the final amount that's due for the 100 hours of work? Is it the fixed fee? Is it $110 an hour? Is it 8%? Is it something else? What's your position?
Our position is that it would have to be based upon this interim billing clause, the amount of each installment would be in proportion to the total amount of fixed fee.
No, just what's the answer? I mean, how do I compute it? It's 100 hours, $20 an hour. What's the fixed fee? At the end of the day, when everything's reconciled, not provisional billing or anything like that, what's the amount that's owed?
At the end of the day, our position is that it is the per hour term that's here in the contract. That may vary from, yes, 110. That may vary from the provisional costs.
But that isn't what was done here. As I gather, less than the maximum was ordered. The fixed fee on what was ordered and paid was 8%. But the problem is that it was significantly less than the estimated total, and that the standby costs need to be considered, and that, in fact, that's what the government contemplated when the contract was entered into, although it doesn't say that.
That's correct. Either way, whether it's...
Not either way, but in fact, what was actually reimbursed, I gather, was not at $1.10 per hour, but was the actual 8%.
It may, if you look at, for example, that may be correct. I'm not... the contracting officers... I mean, sometimes we reimburse them the whole fixed fee. We made mistakes, and on five occasions, Samtech points out, on five occasions, we just gave them the entire fixed fee. On other occasions, we gave them less. And we either did that based upon, the reason it's okay to say either or is that we either did it based upon this 8% number, or we did it on the per hour figure, but we never did it. The contract does not call for it ever to be done on the total number, if that makes sense.
So maybe we should construe that the contract is providing for 8% fixed fee on the hours actually work, which, as I understand it, is not a position that was articulated by either party. In other words, the contractor was saying he gets 100%. You were saying they get $1.10 an hour. Maybe the correct answer is 8%.
That may be true. And if that's the case, then the fixed fee would never exceed
it has to be capped by the maximum.
Right. It would have to be capped by the maximum fixed fee.
But why isn't the correct answer 8%? What they're giving here in the contract is an example of a fixed fee of $1.10 an hour if the hourly rate is $14.03. But that what was contemplated was that if the hourly rate was higher than $14.03, that the fixed fee would be proportionally higher, capped by $170,000.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's not true. The Clause B1 provides for an interim billing mechanism. There's no support in the contract for the idea that the fixed fee should... What that suggests, Your Honor, is that the fixed fee would vary with the costs. That's prohibited, as Amtec repeatedly argues. That's prohibited by the FAR. The fee has to be fixed at the inception of the contract.
No. You argued that it didn't violate the FAR if it varied with the number of hours ordered.
That's correct. That's our argument. It does not violate the FAR for the fee to increase or decrease based upon the number of hours exercised. But it would violate the FAR if the fee varied with the costs. And that's what that scenario suggests, that if the cost is more, then somehow the fee goes up.
Let me ask you the... We have a year, assume just for purposes of my understanding, so we have a year where the only thing that's ordered is 10 hours of someone who costs $20 an hour, okay? When I do the math, that's $200 an hour. What is the fixed fee?
The fixed fee pursuant to the contract then would be $1.10.
Times 10?
Times 10.
Okay, why isn't that the answer? Where is this 8%?
I thought you told me that it was 8%. Where
does this 8% come
from? The 8% comes from clause. If we look at clause B1 of 104.
8%, 110 is 8% of 1403. That's the idea, right?
That's
where the 8% comes from.
Right, that's where it comes from. But if the cost, the problem is that the costs can exceed the estimate. So you can end up with a fee. If you calculate the fee purely on a proportional basis, you can end up with a fee that exceeds the maximum. So that's where, I don't know if I'm answering your question, but it comes from, that 8% comes from this B1 clause, which is an interim billing clause, that says the amount of each installment of the fixed fee shall bear the same proportion to the total amount of fixed fee as the payment on account of the allowable labor costs bears to the estimated labor cost. That's where they're getting that 8% from. And that's what they use on an interim basis. But it does not make sense to use that as the final number.
But that's not the issue in this case, is that your contractor is staffed to provide 154,800 man hours. And let's say, on this example, 10 hours are ordered. Whether this contractor is reimbursed at 8% of $14 or 8% of $20 is not the question. The question is, does he get the reimbursement for the unordered hours because he was required to be staffed to perform that work?
That's correct.
But then that's a difficult question because it is rather counterintuitive, is it not, to enter into a contract, exercise an option which contemplates 154,800 hours of work, order very little of it, but expect the contractor to be able to perform in a timely way at any time during, let's say, an annual option period, which requires a certain amount of preparation and staff, whether it's 8% or something else of a minuscule amount of work, seems to be secondary to this fundamental premise. And the government witnesses, I think, support the position that they expected this service at any time that it was ordered during the option period.
That's correct, but if the government had ordered nothing, if they had not exercised these options, then Amtec would receive nothing.
That's right, but they did exercise the option.
They did.
And that's the problem, if they had not exercised the option.
But they exercised, like, for example, contract R398, option 7 of that contract, there were 67,500 total potential hours. The government exercised an option for 596 of those hours for a fixed fee of about $1,300 as opposed to a total fixed fee of $157,000. They ordered exercised a very, very small portion of the total number of hours.
But did they announce when they exercised it that we only want a few hours out of this option period?
I'm not sure what they announced. But
that's
this,
the problem, isn't it?
The contract
option apparently was exercised for 154,800 hours, give or take. I mean, that's at least a significant undertaking.
But the contract contemplates that the government, the plain language of the contract, in some sense, make sense that the contractor would have to stand by and be ready for the government to order or to exercise or not to exercise these options, but that's what the contract contemplates.
Exactly, it was exercised, so that's not the alternative. The question is, were they required to stand by and be ready for over $100,000, or to stand by and be ready for practically nothing?
The contract contemplates that they would be, that they are required to stand by and be ready for practically nothing. And that they would not.
What's the, how much of the fixed fee is profit and how much is additional cost when it was originally calculated for the contract?
I'm not sure about that, but the
record does not reflect that?
No, but fixed fee, the contractor, if you look, for example, at one of the interim vouchers in volume one of the appendix at 10391, you can see that the Amtec recovered for its overhead, for example, recovered for its labor costs, its travel costs.
Does the fixed fee include profit?
Yes. The fixed fee certainly includes profit.
Well, that's my question, is how much of it is profit and how much of it is overhead costs?
Well, I don't think any of it is overhead costs. I don't know for sure, but it certainly includes profit, and I do know that they could recover their overhead costs
separately
when they recovered their costs. So theoretically, then, if Amtec incurs overhead costs for the 500...
So the standby costs that they're complaining about would be billed separately.
Could be billed. If you look
could
at this...
Could be or would be?
Well, they would be. I mean, they are. If you look at this one example of an interim voucher, that it includes overhead.
Overhead spread over $150,000 is quite different than overhead spread over 10 hours. Certainly, if only 10 hours were ordered in that year, there's no way that a year's worth of overhead can be placed on that, or that anyone ever contemplated that it would.
That's correct, but it's also the case that if the government were to exercise a certain number of hours, Amtec could hire more employees, it could lease more space, it could do all sorts of things. There could be a certain amount of flexibility with the amount of its overhead costs.
Let's ask this explicitly. Suppose they order 100 hours and they incur over that period $200,000 in overhead for that 100 hours. Is it the government's belief that they can bill for the entire $200,000, separately bill for the entire $200,000 in overhead, or do they have to only bill proportionately on a per hour basis?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I don't know if... The FAR provides that the government can reimburse allowable costs. I don't know how overhead is calculated under the FAR. But they certainly did recover for overhead. We know that much.
They certainly can't have recovered their entire overhead if practically no hours were ordered. I'm not sure what you're telling us. It's a curious contract, but it does seem, and government witnesses said, that it was contemplated that there would be substantial work ordered, and this is what it would cost. And when it wasn't ordered, what happens if, in fact, fixed costs are incurred, which can't have been reimbursed? Whether, in fact, the contractor has to bear the burden of a fuzzily drafted contract that the government witnesses say is not really what they had in mind, or not. How does our government deal with the public, with those who provide services to us?
The contractor for Amtec bore the risk that the contract explicitly, plainly contemplates that not all of the hours would be exercised. And if it was plain on the face of the contract. And Amtec bore that risk when it agreed to the base contracts here.
Well,
to the
other. Well, the problem is that your argument makes sense if the fixed fee represents profit. They shouldn't get the profit for the whole thing just because they spent 1 hour of work. But to the extent that the fixed fee represents reimbursement for costs that they would incur regardless of the number of hours of work, the contractor's argument makes sense. And what I'm trying to get at is, would the contractor in that situation recover all its overhead, standby overhead that it incurred? And you're not able to answer that question.
I'm not able to answer it definitively, but I'm sorry, I don't mean to speculate, but certainly they could recover for their costs. And I don't know how far that goes. I just don't. But they did bill for their costs, and they billed separately for their overhead. So at least theoretically, they could recover for their overhead. I'm sorry if that's not entirely satisfactory. I see that I've gone over my time.
Yes, we've exhausted your time. Thank you, Mr. McNamara.
Thank you.
Mr. Ricks?
Yes, Your Honor. If the government had chosen to partially terminate some of these contracts...
What's the answer in terms of the billing for the overhead? If you had standby overhead, would that be separately billable under the contract as a cost? And if so, why not?
We have agreed in this contract to bill a fixed actual cost labor rate for the hours that are worked. And the only billing that we recover any overhead for are those hours. Now, if we bill 10 hours...
How's it calculated?
I'm sorry?
How's the overhead calculated on the hours that are worked?
The overhead is wrapped into the billing rate. It's called a loaded rate. It has all of the benefits. It has all of the corporate overhead. It has the G&A. The actual payment to an employee may be $13 an hour or $14 an hour, but with all the loaded material on it, maybe $21 or $22 an hour, plus whatever fee you get down at the end. So just looking at the hourly rate, we recover none of the standby costs. The problem is...
How do I know that? Is there some place in the record that says you don't recover the standby costs?
That issue wasn't completely raised at the lower court.
Well, that's the problem, because you're arguing that the fixed fee covers the standby overhead costs, but the possibility exists that you were entitled to bill the standby overhead costs separately as costs. How do we know?
There is no mechanism in this contract for us to separately bill the overhead that we incurred if the government only used a small portion of the hours, except from the fixed fee. And in some instances...
How does I know that? What contract language or testimony tells me that what you're saying is correct?
The contracts themselves do not provide for a recovery of cost other than on a rate for the actual cost of the labor order. In other words, we are entitled to recover the loaded rate for that employee for the number of hours that he works on a direct charge to the contract. Hours that person sits in the office waiting to be called, we don't recover that overhead on this contract.
And you're not asking for that. I realize that would be significantly higher than the $170,000 estimated fixed fee per year, but that does, in a sense, work against your argument, doesn't it? Because that is profit. The profit has not been, in a sense, earned because the work wasn't done.
Well, we contend that the profit is earned by virtue of the nature of the contract and the way that it's set up.
But how do you set up, in fact, that this is the option price, which will be billed as we go along? But this is what this option is going to cost you. It's going to cost $170,000 a year, however much of it you use, right, in terms of the cost plus aspect. But it wasn't structured that way. And that is, in fact, what the Court of Federal Claims, I think, relied on, that it wasn't structured that way.
Obviously, we disagree with Judge Williams with respect to that. I still believe that the fixed fee is a fixed fee. Profit covers many things in a federal government contract. There are always in a federal government contract unallowable costs that may be incurred that are paid out of profit. There may be, for instance, if there was an overrun in these cases, we wouldn't have gotten an additional fee.
How much of the fixed fee was profit? Is there a calculation in the record?
There is no calculation in the record, Your Honor, as to what portion of the fixed fee was profit. But from what I know, I can tell you that there were some contracts, because of the number of people that stood by and the length of time they stood by, there was no profit in those contracts. In other contracts, there may have been profit because the people didn't stand by as long or we learned from the government something.
None of this is in the record.
None of that's in the record. It wasn't in the record. Well, in this instance, this case went out on motion for summary judgment. There was no evidence taken in this case at all at the Court of Federal Claims. So there were many things that didn't end up in the record that might have if there had been a trial.
Okay, any more questions, Mr. Riggs? Thank you, Mr. Riggs.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. McNamara. The case is taken under submission.